Good morning, everyone. The topic today is the grandeur of mother worship. And of course, I chose this topic because this is a season when we have so many different pujas, worships of Divine Mother in so many different forms. We've had our Durga Puja already. We'll have our Kali Puja coming up a week from Tuesday. And there's so many others, Jagadhatri Puja, Lakshmi, I don't even know all of them. But this seems to be the season for it. So I thought I would speak about mother worship. I chose this term grandeur of mother worship for two reasons. One is that the philosophy is really magnificent. When we look at the teachings that we have regarding worship of God, not simply worship of God as mother, but there's a whole philosophical system behind it, the Shakta philosophy. We can say it was a very beautiful system. And if we try to pin down Sri Ramakrishna into one school of thought, this is the one that he fits into most comfortably, even though he accepted and appreciated and practiced all different ways of worship and everything. But this is the one that seemed to suit him best. So from that point of view, there's a tremendous amount of beauty and grandeur in this Shakta philosophy. And then this wonderful devotional side, looking upon God as our very own mother, where we have the very sweet relationship. This what Thakur said, this Shantan Bhav. He used to say, Amar Bhav Shantan Bhav. My attitude is that of a child, a small child, worshiping or loving its own mother. And then, which I won't get into today, but there's also this side of Mother Kali, we'll get to that later, the worship of God, not only as the source of everything good and beautiful, but of everything terrible, everything all-inclusive, everything that takes place in this whole universe, that Divine Mother is the source of everything. I wanted to start by looking at this in the context of our traditional Advaita Vedanta, where we always analyze three different things. One is, what is the nature of God or Brahman? What is the nature of the individual or Jiva? And what is the nature of the world or Jagat? All schools of Indian philosophy, Vedanta, Sankhya, others, all the schools have to deal with these three things. If we understand these three things, we know pretty much everything. This covers the whole gamut of all the categories that we talk about in philosophy. What is the nature of God? What is the nature of the world? What is the nature of the individual soul, if there is such a thing? There's a verse which is quoted all of the time. It's so common. It's one of those verses that nobody really knows who said it first. We sometimes attribute it to Shankaracharya. Sometimes we'll see Vyasa said it. But it's a very nice verse because it sums up the entire Vedanta philosophy. Not in one verse, but in half a verse. Shloka dhena, through just half a verse, parakshyami, I will explain to you, yad uktam garanta kotipi, what is discussed, what is explained in thousands and thousands of scriptures, I'll tell you in half a verse. Then it says, Brahma satyam, Brahman alone is real, jagat mithya, this universe is somehow false, and what mithya means, of course, is open to a lot of interpretation. And the jiva, Brahma eva na aparaha, the jiva is none other than Brahman itself, no distinction whatsoever. So this is the position that is taken by Advaita Vedanta, as taught mostly by Shankaracharya and others. So we have the first category of Brahman, which is also interpreted differently for the non-dualists. This is the ultimate reality. Non-dual, which means two things. It means that there's no distinction within it, and there's nothing second to it. So it alone exists, and it doesn't have parts. It's not composed of anything. So it's transcendent, it's absolute. Sometimes we say Satchidananda, existence, knowledge, and bliss. At the same time, from the context of the universe, somehow it's considered to be the ground of the universe, the way that the whole ocean is the ground for the waves. So it has that element to it also. But we have this second idea that what is superimposed on Brahman really is nothing but Brahman itself. The distinction is only name and form. Or even if we think of the ocean and the waves have no real separate existence or reality. It's just a name we give to the surface area of the ocean when it's a little bit disturbed. So this is Brahman. Then Jagat. Jagat literally means that which moves. So it refers to this universe, which is coming and going in cycles. And in the in-between portion, it's also constantly changing. So the transitory nature of the world, which ultimately has no absolute reality to it. It's dependent. It's dependent on the way we perceive it. It's dependent on the ground of a Brahman. It belongs to a different type of category. So we won't call it satya. Here they say mithya. Mithya, whether we say illusion or whether we say changeful or transitory, Thakur liked anitya, that idea, that it's non-eternal. So in Vedanta, if something is not eternal, it's not real. If it comes into existence, goes out of existence, in between, its existence is not absolute. So for the jnani, for those who attain realization through this path, we find that this universe seems to disappear for them at the time of God realization. In this Vivek Churamani, there's a very nice verse where the student has this experience and he says, oh, what happened to this world? Where did it go? I don't find it anymore. Who took it away? So it'll disappear at that time, just as the vision of the snake will disappear when we know that it's only a rope. So that way, so it has no absolute existence that way. Then jiva, this is a very important element in Advaita Vedanta. What is the status of the individual soul? We have a category for jiva, even though there's nothing in reality that corresponds to that term. So what Vedanta will say is that this is it has a phenomenal existence. It appears that there are separate individual souls, just as it'll appear that there are lots of individual suns reflected in different containers of water. There's only one. So for them, for the Advaitins, it's a question of superimposition, falsely dividing one thing into another. We have so many illustrations. If we take the individual soul to be like the space inside of a jar, the jar is incapable, really, of separating the space inside the jar from space, Mahakasha and Ghatakasha. So it gives the appearance, and we talk about it. We'll say, how much space is there in the jar? What we really mean is, how much water can we pour into that jar? Is it a 1 quart? Is it a 1 gallon container that way? But the space inside, even though we say inside, is infinite and unlimited. And when we break that jar, then we won't even ask what happened to the space inside. Did the space inside merge with infinite space? It always was. Right? If we move the jar, are we moving the space inside the jar from one place to another? The jar is passing through space. Space is unchanged. So space is the absolute. So that'll be the real nature of the self, that we're superimposing upadhis, apparently limiting adjuncts, which don't really belong to it. Thakur has his own way of explaining the apparent distinction between one soul and another soul. He says, think of a stick lying on the surface of water, which gives the appearance of separating one side from the other. But it's just lying on the surface. It's still one body of water. So we have so many different illustrations. If we see light coming through all of the windows, and we attribute light to each of the different windows, each will be like an individual soul. The source of light is one. And that's the real self, or Paramatman, appearing to be many because we're taking the window frame as something that belongs to the light, is defining it and separating it. So this is that concept of adhyasa, superimposition with the help of these upadhis. So we find that there really is nothing absolute about the individual soul. It's a concept. It's an idea. But it's very, very real to us because we all feel ourselves to be individuals. And we all identify with this particular body-mind complex that way. So aside from that highest realization, that state of samadhi, or through a very deep type of analysis, it's very hard for us to get rid of this attachment to the ego and to the body, mind, and everything. But for Advaita Vedanta, the ultimate reality will be that the jiva is none other than Brahman itself, or Paramatman. Now, for the Shakta point of view, I've done this before. I like to refer to a very nice Bengali song that was written by one Manmohan Chakravarti. And this song goes, Ma Achen, Mother is, or Ami Achi, and I am. Bhavna ki Achi Amar, what do I have to worry about? Now, it doesn't sound very philosophical, but we'll find that it corresponds to Brahma Satyam Jagamitya Jiva Brahma Vinapara. It's a very nice way to show the difference and similarities between the two schools. I'll say the Shakta school, worshippers of Divine Mother, and the school of Advaita Vedanta. Then the second line says, Mayer hate kai pori ma niechen amar bhar. So it only through Mother's hand that I eat, that I dress, that I do everything. Mother has taken my whole responsibility, my whole burden upon herself for me. So a very nice song. One of these days we'll hear it sung. Huh? At the end, can you do it? Maybe.
I'll try.
Okay. Okay, Bimalda can do it. Okay. You're off the hook. Bimalda. Okay. So we'll have that afterwards. So, as I say, it may sound odd to take some very high, deep, almost impossible philosophy and then a beautiful, simple song to put them, juxtapose them side by side. But you'll see, I hope, if I'm a little bit successful, you'll see that it works, that all the key elements in this Advaita Vedanta philosophy will be matched. And we'll see how they line up together with this very nice song by this Manmohan Chakravarti. So, Brahma Satyam. Brahma Satyam, Brahman is real. Brahman alone exists. Perfectly corresponds to Ma Achen. Ma exists. Mother exists. Okay, because mother, now we're talking about mother as Brahman itself. Maybe not exactly the Nirguna Brahman of Advaita Vedanta, but close enough. So that's the first one. Then, Jagan Mithya, the world is unreal, and Bhavna ki ache amar. Now this one is going to take a little tweaking. But if we say that the world is unreal, then the corresponding side of that is why worry? Huh? If it's not real, why do we worry so much about it? So we'll see. These two, we'll get them to line up a little better later. And then, jiva brahmaiva napara, the jiva is none other than Brahman, to amiachi, I exist. So this is what the Shakta will say with regard to this jiva. It's not saying too much about how I exist. Do I exist as one with Brahman, as an individual? Just I exist. So the nature of the jiva will be correspond to this particular part of the Bengali song. So I wanted this morning to go through some of these teachings about mother worship in light of these three concepts, the nature of God, the nature of the soul, and the nature of the world, with the help of both of these, the Sanskrit verse and this nice Bengali song. Now, there are many schools of Advaita Vedanta, there are many schools of mother worship and everything. I'm going to pretty much stick to what we find in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. The way Thakur talks about worship of the Divine Mother and the way that it's usually practiced. And we'll find that it's really not very different philosophically from Advaita Vedanta, but it's a beautiful blending of a devotional attitude with a deep philosophical foundation. This is, to me, part of the specialty of all of this. Ma Achen, mother exists. Now, what is the nature of this mother, this divine mother that is worshipped in the Shakta tradition, and how does it differ, if at all, how does it differ from the concept of Brahman? Now, Sri Ramakrishna used to tell Swamiji, Narin, his beloved Narin, he said, you criticize this worship of Kali so much. And he did. He used to say when I was young how I hated this mother Kali. He thought it was the lowest form of image worship, idolatry, and bloodthirsty goddess. They're slaughtering goats and everything. He said, but that which you call Brahman, I call Kali. It's nothing different. It's not that she's a goddess that only has this mythological stuff where she kills demons and all of that. He had a very high philosophical understanding of the meaning of Kali, or Divine Mother, we can say. So he would say that the Divine Mother is not something different from Brahman, is the same ultimate reality, only the concept is a little bit more inclusive. Inclusive in the sense that for the Advaitin, when we talk about Brahman alone exists and Brahman alone is real, that means it's unchanging, that means it's transcendent, that means it's nirguna Brahman. If it's saguna, if it has attributes, then already we have distinctions within it. And we already have at least subject attribute distinction there. So the real, when we say Brahman alone is real, Brahma Satyam, we really mean this nirguna Brahman. That means that we can't say anything about it, just this pure consciousness. We can't even say that it's the source of the universe. We can't say anything. So Thakur very often would say, what Brahman is cannot be uttered by the tongue. We can't express it. Mukhe bola jai na. He used to say that over and over again, that it's just something to be experienced in that highest state of samadhi. So the shakta will accept that this is the nature of Brahman, but this isn't the whole story. That which is nirguna is saguna also. That the same Brahman has to have some type of attributes, has to have some type of shakti, some type of power, if ultimately it will be the source of the whole universe, however we understand it. So the concept of Brahman will just be a little fuller, we can say that. Otherwise, they're not talking about two different things, really. Part of the problem is that in the Advaita Vedanta system, we have such a pure concept of Brahman that it's very difficult for us to explain the very existence of the universe. Even if we say that it's just an appearance, how do we explain the appearance of the universe? Even if we say it's unreal, unreal and non-existent are two different things. If it's non-existent, then there's nobody to ask any question. Then there's only Brahman, that's all. But suppose somebody says, what you see is unreal. Okay, that's all right. But how did I come about to be here to see something that's not real? So we even that we can't explain. If we start out with this simply nirguna Brahman, Brahman is actionless. It is nirguna means it doesn't even have the shakti power. Nothing is there. So the Advaita Vedantin has kind of painted himself into a corner. Doesn't know what to do. The existence of the world is a little bit of an inconvenience for the Advaitin. They can't explain it very easily. If they say that Brahman creates it with some type of shakti, then they feel that they're compromising the purity of Brahman, of nirguna Brahman. So they don't even want to give too much of this shakti power to Brahman that way. They'll have to bring in the second concept of Maya, which is also a very tricky type of thing, because now either we have a second reality, Brahman and Maya, two things which we're not allowed to have, right? Or this Brahman, which essentially is some type of little ajnana, little avidya, ignorance is there, it belongs to Brahman. That's also a no-no. How can Brahman, which is pure knowledge, in a word, how can that have anything with even the slightest taint of delusion or illusion or ignorance or anything like that? So sometimes we hear slightly clever explanations, like the snake that will have the little sack inside of venom that he can bite other people and everything, but he himself is not affected by it. because it's protected by this act, something like that. So this Maya is within Brahman, but Brahman is not affected by it. We have different types of interpretations because we're trying to avoid having to say that Brahman creates the world. Then we're bringing in personality and everything. So it's a very difficult situation for the Advaita. It's a difficult situation for all of them. This isn't just Advaita Vedanta. Every philosophical explanation of how this universe comes into existence has its own set of problems. Either we have to think that God wanted to create it, then we're giving some desire to God, making a personal God that way. And even if we solve every possible question, why, how it took place, then we have to ask, how did it turn out so poorly? Why is it such a mess if this is really the handiwork of God and everything? So it's a very difficult thing. So it's not just, I'm not just picking on the Advaitins when it comes to creation. Nobody did a very good job of explaining it. That's why Thakur, he would simply say, who can understand the ways of God and the ways of the world? Don't bother your head too much about all of these things. So we have this idea of Maya. Now, if we try to think that Brahman is somehow like an individual who's sleeping. So a sleeping individual is just pure consciousness. There's nothing taking place within it. But through Maya, which is a way of saying we don't know what happened, through Maya, this individual, a dream occurs. Now, not that the sleeping individual decides to dream. Nobody decides to dream because we're sleeping. Right? There's nobody there. It just kind of emerges out of that. So Brahman is kind of free from deciding to do it in any particular way or anything like that. Why does it turn out the way it does? Everything from the previous one got stored somehow and it comes back out again, just like our dreams are a mishmash of things that we remember during the day, something like that. So we have this idea that this dreamer is something like the Saguna Brahman now. And we have to bring in a little bit of this idea of Shakti. The Advaitins can't help it. So when they talk about Maya, we end up with this Avarana Shakti and this Vikshepa Shakti, two different powers that, one, this Brahman has to somehow cover over its real nature. It has to somehow enter a state of forgetfulness. That means sleep, that way. And then something has to be superimposed upon it, the dream. So we could almost say a kind of projection. This universe is projected out of Brahman. The consciousness itself will be the stuff out of which this universe is made. But the Vedantins really don't put too much emphasis on this, and I think we get in trouble when we ourselves do. That if you look at the Upanishads, you look at the Mahavakyas, everything is what is the nature of the self. This is really the focus, to realize our oneness with the ultimate reality and not get too attached to the world. That this world is a passing show. I like Sri Ramakrishna's explanation. We don't have to ask ourselves, is it illusory? Is it a manifestation of Brahman? Is it just prakriti taking form and going manifestation or unmanifestation? We know that it's fleeting, and we know that we ourselves are fleeting. Everything is anitya, transitory, so why should we get attached to it? For me, this is enough. Anyhow, so this is the way the Advaitin tries to explain all of this, that with the help of Maya. So we're not putting the blame on Brahman itself. Brahman is not deciding to create this world, anything. It's just emerging out of it as the dream comes out of the dreamer, like that. Now, the mother worshippers, on the other hand, they are not embarrassed at all by this power of Brahman. They embrace it, this Shakti, that this becomes for them an essential feature. They say, why do you care? We're worshiping the Divine Mother. Will anyone worship someone who doesn't have some qualities and some attributes? And at least this one attribute to be able to project the universe, and exactly what we find in the Upanishads. To project the universe, to sustain the universe, to dwell within the universe, withdraw the universe. these four things. So in many respects, the Shakta philosophy is closer to what we find in the Upanishads. We don't really find this Maya doctrine and this illusion doctrine there. It's a little bit later. So this universe is not an embarrassment for them. They embrace it. It's a manifestation of the Divine Mother. They see everything as Mother herself. Something like the old Purusha Suktam idea that this universe is the body of God. That way. So we find this in very early hymns and portions of the Upanishads in the old Vedantic tradition. So this power of Brahman is called Shakti. Sometimes we see Brahman and Shakti as two separate things. Shakti belongs to Brahman. For Sri Ramakrishna, he didn't see it that way. Say, Kali and Brahman. He saw it as only Brahman together with this Shakti. And he saw this Shakti as something essential but not absolute. Now, what is the distinction, essential but not absolute? I'll give an example. This is one that Swami Swanaji used to give very often, that a woman has the power to give birth to a child. Now, the woman aspect is absolute. Absolute in the sense that it doesn't change. From the time of birth to the time of death, she's always a woman. But she's not a mother until a child is born. Once the child is born, then the woman becomes a mother, but not in the sense that she's no longer a woman. The woman part never leaves. That's always there. So the nirguna aspect of Brahman is always there. The saguna aspect of Brahman is that motherhood aspect. And as soon as the child is born, then the woman becomes a mother. The birth of the child is the cause of the motherhood of the mother. This, in more Vedantic terms, Brahman becomes Ishwara when the universe is projected. As soon as it's projected, it becomes Ishwara. And then enters and dwells within it and everything. So for the Shakta, they'll embrace this idea that, yes, not only is this due to the power of the Divine Mother, but she herself is the material cause. She herself enters into it. She herself is it. Because this consciousness, if consciousness is projecting everything, it's not that consciousness is creating this universe with wood and stone and brick and everything that's sitting there someplace. The Brahman creates the universe out of itself. The Upanishads will say that. The Advaitins also have to admit that. So we're really talking about two slightly different conceptions of Brahman, that's all. The Advaitin accepts Saguna Brahman, but it's a bit of a mixture of Maya. If we add a little Maya to the Nirguna Brahman, we get Saguna Brahman. The Shaktas will say, no, we're simply adding that power. So not Maya, Shakti. A very subtle distinction, but the attitude changes. See, for Sri Ramakrishna, he didn't look out and see everything as an illusion. He saw everything as the Divine Mother. The Divine Mother has become all this, the Divine Mother dwelling within all beings. So it's more a change in attitude than anything else. So we'll see this idea of bhava. What is our spiritual attitude becomes more important than what is our understanding of the philosophical truth. Philosophical truth is too slippery. We can't really get to it. We adopt an attitude that we find appealing to our sense of logic and appealing to our heart also. So we have in all of these systems, and Sankhya will be one also, that has two sides to it, the male and the female part. And for the Advaita Vedanta, this Brahman is more like the father. The father is necessary, or in Sankhya system also, father is necessary, but uninvolved. Even at the time of creation, when the child is born to the mother, father doesn't even have to be present. As soon as the child is born, he becomes a father. But the mother the child is coming out of the body of the mother. The mother has to go through all the labor pains, go through the whole thing, and then nurses the child and all of that. The mother is fully involved. So this is why the father, as Nirguna Brahman, won't be the object of worship, but the mother. She is the one who does everything. She gives birth to the child. She nourishes the child. And the child is her very own body. The body of the child and the body of the mother are not two separate things. The very cells in the body of the baby were cells in the body of the mother at one time. So what does the father do? It's like the farmer, he'll put some seeds in the ground, then he'll go away. It's the earth which does all the work. So the mother, we have Mother Earth, huh? That way. So this is that idea that we have of the Shakta tradition and why the motherhood is considered so important. Now, jiva, what is the nature of the self? We've already seen with the Advaita Vedanta that there's not this big distinction. The individual soul has no ultimate reality. We transcend that in the highest state of realization, and we realize our perfect oneness with the Brahman or with the Paramatma. Now, what about the mother worshippers? Amiachi, I am. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that my individuality is something absolute and that I can't transcend it? We'll find for Sri Ramakrishna, echoing Ramprasad and a lot of the great Shakta saints that compose so many beautiful songs, it's a question of attitude. It's not a question of philosophy. And this is best expressed by the very nice line from a Ramprasad song, Ami chini hote chayena ma, ami chini kete bhalabashi. I don't want to become sugar. I love to eat sugar. Now, that means I don't want to become Brahman. It means I don't want to lose my individuality in Brahman. I want to have a little separation to enjoy that relationship. Now, a real dualist will say, I can never become Brahman. We're two separate things. This is not what they're saying. They're saying is that I know that that's the ultimate reality. I know I can experience that. But my preference is to enjoy this play, this lila, to enjoy a little bit of separation. So the philosophical position of the Shaktas may be the same. There'll be a Dvaitins from that point of view that ultimately there's no distinction between the child and the mother, but the child wants to see the face of the mother. It's a question of what pleases the child that way. So we can really say that the Shaktas are a Dvaitins from that point of view, with that most important point that the individual souls, supreme soul, are one and the same. But from a practical point of view, they want to have a relationship. They want to be able to worship God. This is what brings joy to them. This is what is most helpful in their spiritual life. So we can say the Shaktas are both non-dualists and realists. They're realistic in their understanding that the sense of I doesn't leave us. Thakur said so many times, we cut it off at the base and it comes up the next day. Just like there's a people tree. If you cut it off, new sprouts will keep coming back. So for a split second, we may realize, yes, this ego is false, that I'm one with the whole universe, I'm one with God. And then as soon as somebody says something to us and it insults us or something, then we raise our fist. Totopuri, who was such a great jnani, strict Advaita Vedantin, he used to keep a dhuni, sacred fire. And somebody came once, Sridoy or Hazra, somebody, and they wanted to take a little wood, burning wood from the fire to light their chillum to smoke some tobacco. They're very terrible thing to do. The sacred fire, to use it to light your tobacco. This Totopuri got furious. That's Ramakrishna left. Yes, now you're saying everything is unreal, and you're so upset somebody taking a little wood from your sacred fire. So this is the nature of the human mind that way. So the ego of the worshiper of the Divine Mother is not something which is considered false. It's something which is considered pliable and changeable. This is a great teaching of Sri Ramakrishna, that we never hear him say that you have to efface this ego, get rid of it completely. We have to do it in the sense of we have to get rid of pride if we take ego that way. But his teaching was always, we have to ripen this, and we have to do it through a relationship. And for him, the purest relationship was the child to the mother. He accepted all of them. In the Vaishnava tradition, we have the five different bhavas, that we can worship God as our beloved, as our friend, as our mother, or child, all of these different things. But this Shakta attitude, worshiping God as the mother, was something that he appealed to him very much. He thought it was a very pure type of relationship. So this was a very common thing for Sri Ramakrishna. As long as this feeling of I remains, then we have to establish a relationship with God. Sometimes he recommended the servant attitude towards the master, but very often he would say this worshiping God as mother is a very pure and wonderful type of relationship. So we see that for the worshiper of the Divine Mother, the relationship and this feeling of I is a little fluid. It can change. We have different relationships with our own mother. And so we can have different relationships with God. And all of these echo the three different schools of Vedanta. Some of them are highly dualistic, where we feel that we're separate. The mother is there and I'm there. This is something like we have in the song. Others that we're a part of mother, and then even our oneness that way. So we have these different aspects where we feel this separation. And this is what brings this feeling of anguish, this vyakulata. If you ever go to a mall, for example, and you see a small child who got separated from its mother, how that child will be crying and is uncontrollably for his mother that way. Sense of separation. Yeah. So that distinction is there. Even in the highest form of love, the love that the lover feels for the beloved, it requires some separation and some distinction and some difference. So we find in all of these bhavas, there has to be some type of distinction there, some dualistic relationship. When the child finally comes and takes the child, mother comes and takes the child on its lap, then we have our qualified non-dualism. The child feels one with the mother, a part of the mother that way. And in the very highest state, the child forgets itself. And not exactly the same as the child will say, oh, I'm one with my mother. But the child completely forgets oneself and sees nothing but mother. See, Thakur had these different moods and different experiences. He used to say, sometimes when I look within, I see there are two. I see the mother is there and the child is there. Sometimes I look within, I see mother alone is there. So we have different attitudes at different times. Even this idea of the formless reality. There's a beautiful song, Nibir Adhara, Adhar Ki, Ma Amar, how does it go? Nibir Adhar Ma, Tomar, Orup, Hamja Ruparashi, Tai Jogi Korimonon, Giri Gohu Bashi. Yeah. In dense darkness, O Mother, your formless beauty sparkles. Formless beauty sparkles in dense darkness. A beautiful song. Absolutely gorgeous song. That's why the yogis meditate in a deep, dark mountain cave that way. They say Ram Prasad, towards the end of his life, that sweet relationship of the child to the mother gradually disappeared, and he worshiped mother as the formless reality that way. So in this mood of oneness, then we see mother everywhere. There's another beautiful song of Ram Prasad where he says, Mother alone exists. When I walk around the town, I'm doing a circumambulation of Mother. When I lie down, I'm meditating on Mother. I'm doing pranam to Mother. A very beautiful song. Everything is Mother. It sees everything that way. Okay, now we get to the last category, Jagat. Now, how do we tie this in? This world is unreal with this idea. What do I have to worry about? Bhavna kiyachyamar. So this is the last line of the song. When we say this world is unreal, we don't have to think of it so much as this physical world. What is our world? Our world is our life. This term, samsara. Samsara, it can mean this physical world, which is coming and going and everything, or it can mean our own individual life. It can mean family also, samsara. If we look at it that way, all of our attachments, all of our relationships are all impermanent. They're all changing. There's nothing that we can really cling to, that we can hold on to, that ultimately we'll lose everything. So if we look at it that way, that our own experienced world, we see that through ignorance, through false identification, through making distinctions, we live in a world of anxiety and fear. The choice of the snake and the rope, to me, was not something arbitrary. We have so many other illustrations that we have. Sometimes they'll give the illustration that it's dark and there's a stump outside, and the thief looks at it and thinks that it's a policeman, and the lover looks at it and thinks it's his beloved waiting. Well, different things. We have so many different illustrations, but the snake and the rope is the one that we always come back to. And to me, the secondary element of it is more important than the primary element. Secondary element is when we see a rope on the ground and we think it's a snake, we get scared. We saw a snake yesterday. Mm-hmm. It came into the building and it was in the closet. Tiny little snake, very cute. Everyone got afraid. Yeah. Very, very sweet, coiled up and everything. Yeah. We caught it and we put it in a little bag and we took it outside. Yeah. So, to me, that this is very important, that this is the source of fear, ignorance. This ignorance that we're all separate, that we're limited, we're small, we're needy people. That we're always trying to fulfill desires that we don't. All of this leads to anxiety and fear. If we can transcend that, if we can see that, no, there's nothing to be afraid of. There's not really a snake. There is nothing but Mother. This is all the play of the Divine Mother. If we see that, then there's nothing for us to have any anxiety about. So this bhavna, this anxiety, this fear, turns out to be a result of this highly dualistic way of living in the world, feeling ourselves separate from others, identifying with his body. We identify with his body, we have a fear of death, we have a fear of pain, we have a fear of illness. It happens with everything. We identify with our senses, then we feel miserable when we can't hear very well, we can't see very well. At the end, everything starts to fade and everything. We're fully identified with that. We think that we ourselves have somehow lost something when it all belongs to the body and to the senses and everything. So this fear that we have, this anxiety that we have, either from the Dvaitic point of view, which will be ignorance, or from the Shakta point of view, will be because we're not relying on Mother. Either one of these can be cured with this spiritual attitude that this world is nothing to cling to, that there's nothing to be afraid of in it, or that this is the play of the Divine Mother. So the fear of the world and the worries of the world will leave those who are worshiping God as Mother because there's this, and we'll get to the second line, because we feel the Mother has taken a full responsibility for us. This is another spiritual attitude. And we have to know when we shift from something that we're thinking is some literally true philosophical position to a spiritual attitude. Nobody can go back and say, yes, oh, if Mother hadn't been there, this would have happened that way, and we don't know. This is a conviction that we develop based on our innermost feeling, that's all. So the real devotee of the Divine Mother can practice this. What is the result of practicing this? Contentment. Wherever Mother places us, we're happy. We don't question anything. We don't complain about anything. Thakur's classic illustration was the kitten. Wherever the mother cat puts the kitten, it's happy. Why? My mother won't put me someplace that's not good for me. This is the conviction. It may be in the fireplace with the ashes. It may be thrown outside in the cold. It could be anywhere. But the kitten thinks, my mother is the one who put me here. So why will I even question it? So a tremendous way of living in the world. We won't have any regrets about anything. We won't question anything. We'll accept everything. We'll be content with everything. We'll see everything not simply as the will of God, but the grace of God. This is a fantastic thing. That Mother has chosen this for me. And as I say, we don't know it literally true or not. But this is the attitude. Mother's chosen this for me. Best possible thing that could have happened to me. No matter what. I end up in a hospital. I have an accident. I say, the best possible thing. I look back and see how much I gained through that experience. If I hadn't had it, how my life wouldn't have changed the way it has. This is the attitude that the devotee has. So once we feel that the burden is lifted from our heads, then it's a tremendous relief. Swami Turiyananda used to give a very nice example. He said that if you submerge yourself in the river, Ganga, you're there. Say you're 2 feet underwater. 2 feet of water, if we picture, you know, a big tub, something like that, would be a tremendous weight on the head. If you were outside and you put that much water on your head, you would have such pain in your neck, you could hardly move. But when we're under the water, the whole river is supporting it. We don't feel anything. So if we can feel that Divine Mother has taken our responsibility, has lifted that weight off of us, then we have a certain freedom. Freedom from fear, freedom from anxiety. So this brings us to this Sharanagati. So all of these things are tied in very intimately with his worship of the Divine Mother. Perfect surrender to the will of Mother. One of the most significant aspects that we have of all of that. We don't have to decide what's good or what's bad. I mean, we have to decide when it comes to doing something, but when the result comes, we accept everything. We accept everything. We don't question anything. In the very highest state, we don't have to make any effort for anything. That Thakur says that the baby monkey will cling to the mother monkey. If you go to the zoo, you'll see mother monkey jumping around. But the kitten won't even do that. Kitten will simply go mew, 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 and the mother will come. And the mother will take it by the neck, scruff of the neck, and carry it and place it wherever it places it, then you're very happy. So this is that type of contentment that comes when we have this attitude. So we find these three very special elements that come from a devotional point of view in the worship of the Divine Mother. One is anuraga, intense love for God, like the child for its mother. In the beginning, the child knows nothing but the mother. Nothing. The child can't distinguish its own body from the mother's body, the infant. The mother is everything to the child. Then there's vyakulata, this restlessness for the vision of God, like the child who's separated from the mother. And sharanagati, this perfect surrender, like the child relying on its mother. So this will remove all fear, all worry, all anxiety from our lives if we can really practice this, and we'll see this whole world as the manifestation of the mother, not as something to be afraid of, not as something delusion, not as the result of Maya, but manifestation of Mother herself. And so this is the goal for the worshippers of the Divine Mother, to see everything as a manifestation of Mother, to see Mother dwelling within all, and to take perfect refuge with the Divine Mother. I want to close just by reading a few lines from one of my favorite poems of Swami Vivekananda called My Play Is Done. Then we'll sit for a few minutes. Take me, O Mother, to those shores where strifes forever cease, beyond all sorrows, beyond tears, beyond even heavenly bliss, whose glory neither sun nor moon nor stars that twinkle bright nor flash of lightning can express, they but reflect its light. Let nevermore delusive dreams veil off thy face from me. My play is done, O Mother, break my chains and make me free.
Devi sarvabhuteshu matri rupena samsthita namastasye namo namaha.
We bow down again and again to the Divine Mother who dwells within the hearts of all beings as our very own Mother.
Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Peace, peace, peace.
Bimalda?